Welcome to the Performance Process. I'm Kaylee Fretz.
I'm Ronan McLaughlin.
And today we're digging into the processes behind breaking records, specifically our records. We're talking with somebody who has been involved in breaking, what did we decide, Ronan? Nine and a half, ten. Something like that. Fascinating individual. Who are we chatting with, Ronan?
We're talking with Johnny Whale, who I think will have come to most people's attention as part of the Hoob Wattbike team that sort of, well, I think it's fair to say they transformed the team pursuit discipline and the track a few years back. Johnny has since gone on to, well, he's won British National Track Championships. He represented Scotland at the Commonwealth Games, despite his Wales name. And he is now a coach and performance consultant. And, well, I suppose notably for this conversation, he is Dan Bigham's coach. He is also, if you look back at the photos of Philippe Ganna's hour record, he is usually the one that Ganna's got an arm around post breaking the hour record. And he is, well, he's been pretty much central to both of those hour records. I think also Giles Loudon's hour record and at least seven or eight others, including breaking five Masters and National hour records in one day just a couple of weeks ago as part of the Watch Up did a week of records thing that we're sort of taking a little bit of claim for. Our guest today, Johnny, was, yeah, he was sort of central and key to all of those successful attempts.
Yes, we're going to get into his sort of his coaching philosophy, his processes behind breaking all these records sort of from start to finish, the way that he thinks about these records and the way that you have to sort of unearth all these little tiny things to break these particular records. I think there's quite a lot that we can take out of this conversation for anybody at home. I certainly took a heck of a lot out of it. And even though I will never do an hour record. I will never attempt it. I have no intention of ever doing so.
Oh, yes.
Ronan on the other hand.
Just when you've made it that clear, I mean, there's nothing that all the listeners want to see more now than you attempting an hour record of some sort. As we discussed in the podcast, maybe rather than an hour record, a 60-minute PB.
35K? What do you think? I think that's probably...
easy. Yeah, I'm sure you've even done that.
No problem.
I think one of the most interesting aspects actually was just Johnny's approach to it certainly wasn't very traditional, and he gets into how actually just multiple failures have led them to success eventually, and how you learn much more from when things aren't going your way or when you aren't blessed with Philippe Ganna levels of natural talent, and you have to just figure out other ways of getting the most out of yourself. So while most of our listeners probably won't be attempting our records, hopefully there are maybe a couple of people out there who are and find this very, very useful. But even for those who are not, I think this podcast and this episode will be particularly interesting and will provide plenty of takeaways that we can apply to whatever it is we are training for.
I think that's going to be a recurring theme on this podcast because
we're doing it well.
Yeah, if we're doing it well, it is all about processes, right? And processes can apply across lots of different things. They can apply to a totally different type of event, for example, than we're actually talking about in today's show. That's enough of us yammering, though. We should get into the conversation with Johnny.
John, I think we might just kick off. We've already briefly introduced you there, but I think we might let you do so in your own words just to start with. We all sort of know you from your Hoob Wattbike days. just give us a sort of brief introduction, how you got to there and how you've now got from being an sort of integral part of that Hoob Wattbike squad to being an integral part of so many hour records and so many different performances that we've seen in recent times.
Yeah. Okay. Nice Freudian slip to start with. So I guess my sort of introduction to sport, I always describe myself as an accidental cyclist. I never really had any ambitions of racing. I personally never really enjoyed that side of it. Like for yourself, you know, that sort of personal like drive to win as me. But then Dan rocked up and this Dan Bingham, and we were going to start a track team. And like I always say, he's only got three friends, so we had to join. It's like a bit unfortunate.
And luckily you only needed four.
Yeah, and luckily you needed four for team suit team. So that's kind of where it started. And I sort of, and literally, it was a nice sort of, you know, the number of people that had arrived at the right time that were like new in their career and actually really good athletes, but needed a bit more time and like had the support, all came together all at once, like finished uni, which is like perfect for us. So that's when I sort of really started. And yes, we spent 4 years doing team pursuit, won a few World Cups, disrupted a few stuff. But that was sort of, you know, that sort of went when the UCI sort of finished off with Nations Cups, really. Well, they changed it into Nations Cups. But and since then, I've sort of gone away from the competing myself, and I'm sort of more in the coaching, performance support, consulting department these days.
Well, is it fair to say that you maybe didn't exactly have the traditional strengths that teams were looking for in a team pursuit, but you found a way, and the team found a way to utilize the strengths that you did have to sort of improve the team's overall performance? Do you want to touch on that a bit? Because I think that sort of leads us on and gives us an insight into the mindset that you maybe take into your coaching and all the R record stuff we're about to discuss.
Yeah, well, this is Jacob Tiffer's, you know, famous saying of the, you know, our gene pool is four man deep. We had four riders. We had to create a solution that would compete at world level. And for me personally, I'm a sprinter, like physiology. Like I'm a sprinter that hates sprinting. Like I'm desperate to be a 6 kilo climber. So I've just sort of spent, and imagine if you're not competing, you're just riding your bike for fun, really. Like, I mean, I think like, I used to work in fine dining, and I would ride an hour to work, you know, fasted as hard as I can, but I'm a pure sprinter. So it just sort of morphed physiology slightly, like just accidentally over the years. But, yeah, so I had a very low CP back in the day, critical power, and like I've got a big anaerobic capacity. And it was sort of the performance problem we had was that whenever I was in the wheels, like I was just completely burning up in a team pursuit, and I was just not being able to contribute anything worthwhile for my second turn. Plus, like the dynamics we had originally, where none of us had the team pursuit skills, you know, because we were all 25, 26 when we started riding team pursuit. And at the time, we didn't really appreciate how important all those little, you know, the sort of junior, like Olympic ODP, like camps you have when you're 12 years old and you just go and just mess around on the track, really. And like you learn those skills, how to ride on the wheel, how to change, how to like stuff that people take for granted. Like we just had no concept of that. And when you're sort of physiologically lacking, plus technically lacking, and you've got no resources to give you the track time available, you know, we're jumping in and out between 60-year-old people trying to come around for fun with their mates, and we're trying to compete for World Cups and have like hardly any resources at the time. It was, you know, we kind of had to make a strategy based around who we were at the time. And for me, that meant I would do a sort of long turn from P2 in the line and then just bail straight away. So for me, it was, you know, a minute and 40 event, you know, and it was very much a solo team pursuit, if that makes sense. It was always like a really funny dynamic of like, even though it's such a great team event and I'm highly motivated for my teammates, like ultimately, like Dan would do his first lap and then it's just kind of me, and then I would leave the party.
So yeah, for the benefit of the listeners, Dan would start the four-man team and after a lap he would pull off, you'd come around the front, and you were doing five of the 16 laps of a 4 kilometer pursuit.
Oh, a bit more than that. So six and a half, okay. Ish was the I hung around for a bit longer.
Even more. and then it was up to those guys to carry it home. But that's a sort of tactic that has been copied quite a bit.
It has been copied, but it's probably like kind of like nice things we'll talk about on this podcast, really, is that like it is a tactic that can work, but you kind of need the ingredients to make the cake, if you will, you know. And it's also like, it is an unusual effort that requires a unique physiology, but also like to train it is really hard, because you can never, in that sort of bail role, it's not like you're doing a minute and a half as hard as you can. You know, you have to, the delivery velocity is like so important, and how you deliver that time is what's crucial. And just kind of getting used to like the perception of effort when you're on the limit, you know, because if you lose 2K an hour, like you've the boys, you know, like you have to be really like on it in that delivery, and like that takes training. And it's also like I wasn't training for a 4 minute team pursuit. I was training for a minute and a half event, which is like very different demand. So it's you know, whereas a team shoot is maybe, you know, 15% anaerobic, my event is probably about 50-50.
How did you come up with this?
Where did it start with? I mean, if you sort of, if you backtrack it a bit, it was originally, I was originally P1 and I would literally do four laps and go. That was how it sort of started. And then Mehdi Cordy, who's a, well, he's a Dutch sprint coach now, but he was hanging around British Cycling at the time. He literally sort of came up to us at a random session in Glasgow before a race and was like, have you guys thought about doing this differently? and, you know, it took these sort of like someone else to come in and sort of help us out and see, because he literally just said, go P2 and see what happens. But, and what it sort of meant was it like drastically reduced the energy expenditure for me for that first lap. Like, went from being a basically a maximal 20 second sprint to being, you know, 70%. Like, I was just twiddling my thumbs on Dan's wheel, like, get out of the way, mate. But it meant that I had like extra energy to distribute later in the race. You know, how did you get to it is like a long sort of story of failure, really, of like stuff not working well. I mean, I remember like the original nationals we won, I remember finishing the race because originally I did a second turn. It wasn't a very good second turn, but it existed. And I just remember thinking, yeah, finishing it. And like, that was a bit shit. I could do better than this. But luckily we had like the, this is where you haven't got a coach and you haven't got 10 other riders. Because if I was in an NGB and I'd done, you know, these sort of performances, it would have been like, cool, thanks for your time, Johnny, but you're not good enough. Whereas we kind of had the luxury, for me anyway, of like, you know, tailoring a program around my physiology, around my psychology, and around my performance.
He's on 216 laps, so he can afford to tie up a little bit. He's hurting now. This is where the crowd are pushing back on him. He's got just over a minute to go. Like, it's going to take a lot of it. It takes something special because it's not clapping now. We're 54 points. That's 4.2.
One thing that seems obvious to me from the outside looking in is at some point, especially with Dan, you went from falling apart at 30 or 40 minutes into the hour record to all of a sudden every hour record you turn your hand to has been phenomenally successful. And what's not obvious about that is just how you've made that shift. So I think that's a good place to start is, maybe the one question that then leads to the rest of this podcast is, what is your secret to our record?
What is the secret? I suppose the secret is we don't really know what the secret is, you know, but we're willing to go and find out. I think historically across our records, there's a great misunderstanding of what the actual demands of the hour record is. And there's kind of like a big cultural, you know, everyone's, it's, well, I blame Eddie Merckx for this, which when he, because obviously he broke the hour record in, was it 1984, I think, in Mexico City. And I think it's just the most beautiful piece of marketing where you had the best rider in the world at the time, broke the most prestigious hour record in the time. And then he spent the next 20 years telling everyone how impossible it was and how it was a superhuman effort and how, you know, nobody could repeat it.
Might have had something to do with the fact that he broke like 5K and 10K records.
Well, this is what we mean. He rode it like an idiot and he could have gone so much further if he'd done it the next day. You know, if he'd done it again, you know, like the kind of the learnings to do that. But like, he'd never done an hour record before then. That was his first time doing one. And I think the way that we've learned and progressed is by repeating the event and like actually learning on it. Like any event, any race you do, like if you did a 10-mile time trial tomorrow and it was your first ever time, you would get better if you did it next week. Like you will learn on it. And I think people assume that just because it's an hour and it's riding a time trial bike, that's a time trial. But ultimately, like the demands of the two, while it's still pedaling at the end of the day, it is very, very different. So the simple like, how have we sort of learned is very boring in that we've done a lot of them.
How does it differ from a time trial? Like one of the few things I know about it is that the G-forces exerted on the rider going through the banking twice a lap, every lap for an hour has a huge impact. But is that the only difference or what are the differences?
Well, how long is this podcast going to be? Is the answer to that one. I think...
An hour.
Well, I need more than that if we're going to talk about it. How is it different? I think there's a physiological aspect of it, of the muscles are always in tension for an hour, which is something that's very, very different to the road. You know, there's no cornering, there's no getting out of position, there's no shuffling, there's none of this. But I really think that the big one is just people overestimate what they can do, like, a lot. I think it's the common thing we have is people come to us and say, I can do 380 watts on the road, so I will be able to do 380 watts on the track. And that's just clearly not the case across everyone we've ever come across. Like, there is always a drop off, and it's very different for that individual rider.
Is there like an average drop off, or?
It's a very, very individual. It can be as much as 50 watts, can be as little as 20 watts. It's significant. And the exact fatigue mechanisms around that, I'm not really 100% certain on, so I couldn't really tell you. But we just know that it exists ultimately. And it's something interesting that we kind of discovered really at the Watchshop week of ours, which was the sort of like, we had to sort of adapt a lot of our pacing plans and like how we execute the races differently. Because originally you kind of come in and we're like, I've got these processes that work really well with Joss, with Dan, with Filippo. Like, let's just copy this basically, like how we execute the race. But ultimately, you know, these are the elite of the elite, like super freaks, that they are different to your master's riders who don't have 20 years of, you know, being a world tour rider in your legs. And it's a nice research on that we sort of come across, which is like like how long can you ride your FTP, like it being dependent on your actual VO2 max, and there being like a good relationship between that and your sort of the durability aspect of the hour and you know, how stable is your threshold, is kind of very different between riders. It trends nicely in that, you know, basically the higher your CP, the more durable and, you know, the more hours you've done in the last 2 years, these sort of like long-term durability metrics do kind of work. But ultimately, like, you can't find out until you do it. There was that like chart of like how much you fuck around and how much you learn, if you will. with Dan, we kind of, you know, we approached the problem and we were like, let's find out. So we did we've done a number of like fully like censored up hour records with a lot of people now. And basically what we do is we take you to the track, we make you ride an hour record, but we put it like, we sort of shower you in sports science, if you will. And it kind of started where we were like, what can we measure? Like, what's actually useful? Is it, we had like muscle EMG, core temp, like biomech sensors, like, you know, the works. Like, if it was published in some sort of sports science paper, we tried to put it on you. There's some funny photos floating around of putting sensors up all sorts of holes of Dan. But it's,
oh god.
And we kind of like, well, what we originally thought was like, if we just throw enough stuff on the wall, we'll find out where does the physiology break down, and how can we then create a training plan to stop that breaking down ultimately. Which I think the big learning for us was for that initial record we did with Dan was because we were like perfectly confident that he was going to absolutely smash it out of the park that day. You know, it's like we've done a lot of training, a lot of preparation, and we were like,
October 21.
Yeah, this was the during COVID lockdown hour. 2021.
Okay, so not when he broke Bradley Wiggins' record.
Wiggins was Dan. I think Dan's done 7 hours now. He's done quite a few of them. So this was like the real discovery, which was everyone falls apart at 40 minutes, you know, we're just like, what is happening? And we kind of saw this across with everybody else, because there's a high failure rate in the hour record of like, you've got really elite level guys that are spending a lot of cash and spending an entire year focusing on the hour record, yet they're failing. And we're just like, people aren't stupid. You know, like, there's something in their calculations and how they're like assessing performance, and then how that impacts like the actual performance, is like, there is a performance gap there. Which is why we sort of went along this route. This is kind of where the key, I think, like a key expression that we have is like a 30 minutes isn't half an hour, which is like everyone's physiology starts to break down at that. There's always this crisis point around sort of, you know, was it 35 to 40 minutes-ish is where, you know, stuff goes south. And is there like, what we've learned from, you know, just breaking down the event and analyzing everything is like the physiology shifts, like how your pedal shifts, where your core temperature sits, shifts, where your breathing characteristics occur, they shift. So Dan basically sat on Wiggins' hour record for 40 minutes, and then he rode around at like 300 watts, twiddling his thumbs, while sat on the rev limiter trying as hard as he can. And it's kind of painful to watch. And it's like, what's happened? there's a nice little animation we've got where we literally, this is where the sort of like the super negative pacing strategy sort of came from. And this is kind of like the big, I don't want to call it revolution, because it's like everyone's been native facing stuff for years, but it's, you know, historically in hour records, what people do is you sit on the average speed of the hour record. And then if you've got any more in the last sort of 5 minutes, you do more.
Which was always considered the safer way to do it was if you were going to attempt it, you were confident you could break it. So sit on what you had to break and then left it at the end, I guess. But
exactly.
To touch on what you were saying, the super negative splitting, what users started doing is actually starting incredibly slow to the point where people in the track center are getting very uncomfortable that this was a waste of our time coming to watch this.
I think the best one for that was with Dan's mum, because nobody had told Dan's mum what was happening. And he was like, in the, you know, the timing board, it's like, oh, Dan is 20 seconds behind the record. And he's just like, oh no, come all the way to Switzerland to watch this. this is like what is a negative split in that, like, because in theory, like Alex Dyset, Rowan Dennis, like Jens Voigt, these guys all did negative splits. If you look at it, they did all accelerate in the last 15 minutes. But what they've done is they sat on pace and then accelerated. Whereas we're sitting, for example, Dan is literally 20 seconds behind schedule at 20 minutes into the hour. Like, that's a lot. Like, he literally has to catch himself. You know, he's been lapped by the record, if you will. But what this kind of like showed us was it was all around delaying that fatigue as late as we can into the hour. And it kind of like I said, obviously going back to this Manchester, I was like, Dan, it had literally been a disaster. Like, I can't stress to you how horrendous it was watching it. Like, the poor guy, like, slogging himself around. But he still went really far, you know, like, we sort of finished him like this. He still did like the fifth fastest hour record ever when it was like the last 20 minutes was very unelite. So we literally just sort of flipped the graph around. We were like, well, what would happen if you rode 300 watts for the first 20 minutes and then 350? Like, you would have actually gone the same distance and it would have felt a lot nicer. but it's, and this is kind of where the evolution went with Dan, is that, you know, so then we did a training hour in Odense where he did exactly this. It was just incredibly slow at the start, and then he ramped it up, and that kind of gave him the confidence in this strategy works. And it's, you know, I think, again, this is where it's a little bit complicated in that, you know, Dan does have the ability to ramp it. You know, like, you can't...
That's what I was going to say there, is that you're sort of making it sound a little bit easier. And one thing I haven't heard mentioned is just how difficult it would be to sit 20 seconds down on Bradley Wiggins' hour record pace.
I mean, you've kind of had... No. You have to have, like, the... We always sort of talk around, like, the what's CDA requirement for whatever it is for the record you need is, you know, fairly easy to work out. Like, that's like the entry requirements that'll get you into the club. And then the optimization happens, like, along the route, and this sort of the pacing plans, the training, the heat training, or like the positional changes you might want to make. Like, this is kind of like, you know, that's perfecting the cake, if you will. But, you know, you do ultimately need to be a strong bastard to break one of these records. Like, it's, you know, you need the physiological requirements. You need a good CDA.
Do you, not to take us down a rabbit hole here, but do you happen to have any, like, watts to CDA numbers that, you know, result in X distance? Or just for reference at home, I'm thinking of, you know, more and more people are aero testing. If you know your CDA is 0.2 and you can do 350 watts, how far does that get you? Or if you can do, yeah, just what those calculations are.
There's a nice blog on a blog, whatever you want to call it, on the WattShot website, which tells you exactly that. It's a nice graph of this is, you know, this is what power you think you can do for an hour. This is what your CDA would need to be. Where it shows, because it's just a graph, you just carve up, like, either your CDA gets lower or your power gets higher. Like, it's a really easy, like, formula to work out. But the problem is with athletes is that it's actually really hard to make elite athletes better. Like, I think the key learning lessons we've had with Dan is that, like, across all of his hours, like, from the first one he did in Derby in 2000, we did, like, I think he did 52.6K, like, through his world record of 55.5, he has done basically the same power across all of them. So then it's like, you know, it's where is it worth spending your time? Like, to improve your power by 10 watts when you're already an elite athlete is very, very hard / near impossible. But it's it's very manageable to put that time and energy into your aero testing. And you can then make decisions in your training that will optimize your performance in that hour record in terms of like, so you may do a session that's potentially not, you know, potentially isn't, you know, research approved, if you will, of like, this isn't the best VO2 session for you, but perhaps it's the best session you can do that can improve your position discipline and it can improve your CDA stability across the hour. So it's kind of like a big trade-off then of like, where's it worth spending time? Where's it worth spending your effort? I mean, and the beauty of this is that it's kind of a secret sauce, is that there is no answer. It depends on everyone. And like I say, like I've done a lot of these hour records and it is exactly the same process for everyone, but everyone has had a different answer, which is incredibly frustrating because it would be nice to know roughly what to do now, but you kind of just have to test it. You have to try, you have to find out where that individual athlete's weak spots are and make a plan around that.
This sort of super negative pacing, is that something you find translates off of a velodrome particularly well, or like, is this something that we're going to see pop up elsewhere, or is this really a function of how unique an hour record is?
Yes, no is the answer. Like, I think if you look at, I think marathon running is a good example of this, where, you know, the aerodynamic, and there's no big aero penalty of having to ride extra fast when you're running. And also there's no like hills or corners or things like this. So when you're riding like a Tour de France time trial, say, or like a local 25-mile time trial, say, like, there will generally be headwinds, there'll be hills. And then it kind of changes the scenario a bit, where it's like, it's actually maybe physiologically disadvantageous to, you know, go off aggressively and go off hard. But overall, in terms of your performance and where time matters, it benefits you to do that. Whereas in the hour, it's just you on the track, on your own, no wind. Like, you know, there's none of those sort of limitations, which is why you can be more strategic around how you pace it. You know, we're talking pacing to, you know, two decimal places on a lap. You know, it's very, very minute in the grand scheme of things, but it is very powerful. But generally, if it's a flat out and back time trial, you know, if you're going to do it, you always want to negatively pace it. I would suggest if there's no hills and there's no winds, like, you want to have the second half more than the first.
Is there like a lower and an upper distance limit to what you would negatives? But I'm thinking, is like 10 mile time trial, is that short enough that you would just flat pace it? Or are you still negative splitting that? And then the opposite end of things, if someone's doing a 24 hour time trial, are you negative splitting that also?
Well, because I think if you're doing a 24 hour time trial, I think you need to get your head looked at. I think that's the first problem on that one. I mean, I think the answer to that is, look how guys and girls are pacing the individual pursuit on the track. Like, that's a three minute event for the girls, 4 minute event for the boys. Like, that's being aggressively negatively paced. So it is advantageous to negatively pace ultimately. Everyone knows the feeling of being completely cooked. Like, if everyone on this is listening to this, like, go out and do a 4 minute effort and do 120% of your power for the first minute and then 80% for the rest. Like, it's not a fun way to ride it. But then if you flip it around, it's psychologically like, you're putting yourself in a challenge state rather than a threat state. You're not trying to hang on to this. You know, you're not cooked, you're not on the rivet, and you're just kind of grovel around, which kind of leads to the knock-on impact to physiology of like your pedaling efficiency, your gross efficiency drops. So it's actually harder to produce the same amount of work. Negatively pace everything.
This podcast is obviously about, you know, the process of performances, and the vast majority of listening to this will never be gearing up for an hour record. But I'm interested, you mentioned how the approach will differ for each rider and you haven't found one approach that works for all, but I'm interested in the process of understanding which approach will work best for each rider. How do you determine what's the best approach for Dan versus the best approach for one of the riders who was at the Watch Up week there a couple weeks ago?
How do you determine it? Like, it goes back to having a close relationship with the riders. I think this is kind of the big sort of one that nobody talks about and nobody really thinks about is that it's mentally very, very hard to do it. Like, you are literally on your own in a track for an hour, And if you're lucky, you've got me shouting at you once every 16 seconds, but you know, you're on your own there. Like, it's a very, very lonely place. So a lot of the, you know, we can talk about, you know, the negatively pacing, but like, is the negatively pacing helping you from a physiological point of view? Yes. But it's also helping you from a psychological point of view of keeping you under a controlled state for longer and like keep your controlled, you're in control of your actions. And you kind of, I like to sort of describe it as like, you just, you know, you're coiling it up. You're getting this, you know, ready to explode. You're mentally, you're in that sort of state where you're like, I want to get to 15 minutes. And as soon as that clock ticks by, I'm going to absolutely send it. And you're really attacking that final quarter of the race. This is, you know, how do you quantify that? That's a psychological journey you've gone with the rider, you know, to improve their understanding of their own physiology and also the demands of the event. And like, what are you going to be thinking about at this point of the race? Like, how are you going to tweak this? And then it's like, by doing the simulations, by having that sort of long process, you kind of work out where each rider's break points are. So for Dan, we had a few sort of key points. Like, we know where he fails. Like, he loses breathing, and then he shifts in his saddle. The sort of the two main ones. And what happens is when stuff starts going wrong, you then try and cope in a different way. So for example, like, you'll ride a shit line and you're trying to, like, because you're trying to put more power in it. You know, you're trying to compensate in different ways. And it's like I say, it's lonely out there, and it's very easy for us to talk now and be like, yes, you should focus on riding a good line. Like, you know, you should hold a good position. But when your core temp's at 40 degrees and you're absolutely cooked and you feel like you're going to let your friends down and, you know, you've put all this investment in, it's hard to think clearly and rationally. And this is where the sort of the feedback relationship between the sort of what I love is like the coach, like being on the side, you can literally see what's about to happen. You can be like, in three laps time, I know it's going to go south. But then, you know, because you've done the work in the build-up, that you know, right, this rider, this is our mental cue. So for Dan, I would just shout breathing. And we know that that's the key for him. And he's like, right, for the next four laps, all I'm going to focus on is my breathing. And it's just giving you that sort of mental reset to, you know, to bring you back, to center you, to stick yourself to good processes. And these sort of like individual cues were very different for each rider.
Hey folks, Ronan here, just to say thank you for listening to this short taste of the first episode of Performance Process. If you've been enjoying this podcast and want to listen to the rest of it, you'll need to head over to escapecollective.com/join and sign up there, because Performance Process is an Escape members only podcast, which means that you need to be an Escape member to listen to the rest of it. So if you're not, I'm afraid that's all there is for today, folks. But if you do want to hear the rest of it, head on over, sign up at escapecollective.com/join. And once you've done so, you'll get an email with instructions for adding the private member feed to your podcast app of choice, be that Apple Podcast, be whatever. And it's quick and easy to do so. And you can listen to the rest of this chat with John A. Whale. Thank you.